Grizzly One.
Their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Led Zeppelin, the Immigrant Song. On this, the drive home at 5, our federal holiday honoring the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr., and right on time. Because when you listen to the words, whether you were in a drug-induced psychosis over the years or you were sane and sober, you listen to the words of Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song, and they're singing about the Norsemen coming over in their long ships from which country? Norway. Bringing to our shores the notion that Eric the Red and Leif Erikson discovered the New World. I know that contradicts what we believe Christopher Columbus having done, if you're Italian-American, or the Irish who still perpetuate the notion that it was St. Brendan the Navigator. But the point being is, that's what that song is about. And as much as they love their reindeer and their socialist way of life in which the Norsemen are taken care of from the cradle to the grave, and they have their lutefisk and fisker balls, and what is considered the happiest country in the world, they're not knocking down our doors to come. Sorry, Mr. President, just ain't happening. But it's all part of the discussion about what the president said this past Thursday when the bipartisan group of senators, led by Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, came to the president to say, we have a compromise here for the DACA situation that involves strengthening border security. President had 6 other Republican congressmen there who were not at all in favor of that. And so they sat down for a long discussion. And from it, we were told that the president referred to Haiti, El Salvador, and African countries and people trying to get here as being from bovine organite holes. I'm not permitted to use the actual term. President later said, I never said it. Dick Durbin said, yes, you did. Lindsey Graham said, I had words with the president. The president said, oh, I didn't say it. It was rough language. And then Cotton and Perdue, the Republicans, after 48 hours of taking the code of omerta, said, hey, yeah, we do remember. He didn't say anything like that. But as we hear in the drive home at 5 and the hawk is talking outside, that's right, locally, it's getting cold out there with snow in the forecast for tomorrow. It's chilly. It's chilly in the White House because the new head of the Department of Homeland Security was in the bullpen with Chris Wallace of the Fox News Channel. Now, she was sitting in that meeting and listened to how she had to do a form of verbal rope-a-dope.
Secretary, you were in that meeting in the Oval Office. Did the president say that?
I don't recall him saying that exact phrase. I think he has been clear, and I would certainly say undoubtedly the president will continue to use strong language when it comes to this issue because he feels very passionate about it.
It seems to me you were in the meeting when these comments were made. I can understand you either saying they were said or they were not said. It is pretty shocking language, and to say I don't recall seems implausible. If the president of the United States used the word blank hole, talking about countries in the Oval Office, or didn't say it, I would know.
I understand the question. It was an impassioned conversation. I don't recall that specific phrase being used. That's all I can say about that.
Remember there was that time that President then Clinton had to sit down with his secretary, Betty Curie, and nourish her memory about Monica Lewinsky? Do you think the president and his minions had to nourish people's memories? I don't know. Let's go to Scotty Nell Hughes. She's joined us so many times in the past in these kind of situations when whose side are you on, who do you believe is in the air. Scotty Nell Hughes, now that you've had an opportunity to sort of assess what everyone has said that took place in that meeting, what conclusion have you come to?
Well, listen, I, knowing the president, would want to say, no, he didn't say it. But I also know he's a New Yorker, and I know you New Yorkers can say certain things at different times. So that's not what I want to debate, whether or not he said or said it. I think that's very trivial. I think the question is, what was the context and what was his motivation for saying or potentially saying these words? What was he hoping to do? And more importantly, was he actually hoping to implode the conversation, which is what has happened since this has all exploded? Think about it. If this was an agreement that Dick Durbin and all the Democrats liked going into it, do you think we would be having this conversation? Do you think Dick Durbin would have said that the president said these comments? Probably not. So the Democrats didn't like this deal. The Republicans were getting pushed back and didn't like the deal. So Donald Trump did what President Donald Trump said he would do earlier in the week, and he took the heat. And right now, we are back to the starting blocks on this program.
No, understood. But you see where I think he really made a major problem for him, particularly amongst people of color who think that the deck is stacked against them in the Trump administration. You know, he mentioned Haiti, El Salvador, African countries. Whatever the terminology he used, he admitted there was harsh language. And then he said, well, why can't they be like Norwegians? I mean, we should be encouraging Norwegians to come. Now, I don't know about you, Scotty Nell Hughes. I don't want people from socialist countries where they've been taken care of from the cradle to the grave. They're already happy in their circumstance. They love their reindeer. They love their lifestyle. They're not knocking down our doors to come here. Why would he be encouraging that when he knows people from Norway don't want to come here?
Well, let me point this out to you, and I think this is what, and I'm so shocked that people are missing this, and I think this is the obvious, and Curtis, you probably, because you actually have a thousand things going on, didn't recognize this. But it's real obvious, it's real simple why the president threw Norway in there. He could have thrown a variety of countries. But he had just spent the last 2 days with Prime Minister Solberg of Norway. He had just spent time with her. So that's why that country's name was pulled out and why he said it, because he had just spent so much time learning about the country, being with the prime minister. And it's nothing more than just that. It wasn't meant to be any sort of a comparison between Norway and Haiti and those sorts of countries. It was simply he had just that morning done a press conference with the prime minister.
I know, but you know how it sounded to a lot of people, how it came off, because Norway is so white, blonde hair, blue eyed, so Lutheran, not many immigrants. I mean, for instance, had he used the country Poland, which is predominantly white, they had given him a standing ovation when he spoke there, maybe the best reception he's had in any foreign country. And we have a lot of illegal Poles here already, you know, who are shaping up for day labor, who are trying to avoid Limigra and ICE. So that might have been a much better analogy, because we know there are a lot of Poles who still want to come here.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. Trust me, with every single episode of what I'm now calling the mayhem media that President Trump has created that they give us each day, you're right. There could have been better countries and other countries to choose. But here's the other thing that I think people are missing in this debate is, do you actually identify a country based on the people or the government? I hands down believe that this president was not defending, was not trying to call out or insult the people of Haiti. What he was calling out was the corrupt government of Haiti and the billions of dollars we have sent over the years, but especially since the last hurricane and the last earthquake. He's calling out those governments. So, you know what? I don't think he was not insulting the people of Haiti as this is being spun into be. He was insulting a very corrupt government that continues to not allow reforms to happen, to not allow the aid, the much needed aid to get to the people. And I think that right there is the heart of it. But people who want to hate on President Trump are going to continue to take
the
Senate and make him a racist.
But Scotty now used on another issue, the president said, well, maybe from now on we'll tape all the meetings, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But he had an interview taped with the Wall Street Journal, his tape, Kelly's tape, his chief of staff, who taped that interview, and the Wall Street Journal taped that interview. You can't be any friendlier than the Wall Street Journal has been to the Trump administration. And yet he attacked him as being part of fake news because he claims he said one thing in the tape. The Wall Street Journal said another. When I listened to the tape, the Wall Street Journal was correct and the president wrong. Why can't he simply acknowledge I was wrong and be done with it?
No, I agree with you. And I think that is one point right there that needs to be said. And that's why I do agree with the president that we do need to. The meeting he did last week where he opened the cameras in, I think we got more accomplished towards immigration reform than we had yet. Now, of course, it was all ruined the next day and it all imploded the next day. But at least we saw that, you know, what it was like to have both sides negotiating. I agree with you. It's kind of like I know I'm not a perfect parent. I apologize and make mistakes. The problem is, I think, with this president, if he even admits one mistake, then they use that and blow it up as if he just absolutely did something horrible.
I know, but Scotty now used with friends. He was with friends at the Wall Street Journal. They both taped it. We heard the tape. The Wall Street Journal was correct. It was a small word differential. Not, and no biggie. It wasn't going to affect geopolitical issues in the world. But the president made it out to be a major issue, started tweeting fake news Wall Street Journal. Hey, if you're Wall Street Journal, if you're Murdoch, if you run the Post, you may be saying, you know, I've given you tactical air support maybe when you didn't deserve it. You know, maybe I need to rethink this because you're attacking the hand that has protected you.
Well, at the same time, we learned through Fire and Fury, maybe partial truth of that show, that Murdoch might not be the best friend of President Trump as he's always made it out to be. So maybe true colors are showing in this. You know what? That's the one good thing that's going to be in all of this. And I agree with you with the Wall Street Journal, the president. But you also have to recognize this president starts, he wakes up the moment his feet hit the ground until the minute he goes to sleep. There are conversations with media. There are conversations with politicians. There's a lot of things going on, not just watching the Gorilla Channel and eating Big Macs, as social media would like you to believe. This president is actually working hard. And so for him to remember word after word, no, but he is a human. He does make mistakes. At the same time, he should also be able to admit them as well.
Do appreciate that, Scotty Nell Hughes. Let's just hope that as he tapes all of his conversations now, which I have no problem with, for accuracy to verify who said what, that there aren't 22 minutes of a missing tape. Remember Rosemary Woods, the secretary for Richard Nixon, who eliminated 22 minutes of that tape? Let's just hope it is the tape and there are no edits made.
Curtis Lewa.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
Fine 27 on this to drive home at 5. And ladies and gentlemen, I've got fire that are piercing through my nostrils and coming out of my earlobes. When I read about this story over the weekend, a combined federal force of U.S. Postal Service inspectors, members of the DEA, and also the Department of Homeland Security, a threesome, right? The Trinity, went to the home of Anthony Marino, who lives in Staten Island, age 45, a firefighter who must have signed up pretty late in his life because at the age of 45, a lot of guys are opting out, you know, 20 years, half pay, full boat, all benefits to the day they die, and they end up with an ice cream parlor, you know, in Port St. Lucie, where the Mets pretty soon will have pitchers and catchers coming. And so they have a double income for the rest of their life. But he's been at Ladder 11 in the East Village for 11 years. And he comes from Staten Island. Some call it the Forgotten Island, but you can't forget it because when it comes to opioid and heroin addiction and fentanyl addiction per capita per person, it rivals the problems of the South Bronx. And in fact, in the nation, in comparison to even the hillbillies there in Appalachia, in Kentucky and West Virginia that have a serious opioid problem. But let's cut to the chase. What was he being busted for? He got online. And he reached a fentanyl dealer in Red China in Shanghai. Yeah, talking about you know, the dark side of the net. Yeah, what dark side? This guy's a vendor. It's like the Red Chinese. They manufacture it in their factories and chemical labs. They put it into the bellies of the ship that they send over with their products for Walmart and other consumer outlets. And it's brought in. Back right through the Straits of the Verrazano, through the Arthur Kill, the Kill Van Kull. And then all of a sudden, it's in the port of Newark and Elizabeth. It's in one of these cargo containers. And next spot, it's being dealt in the streets of the tri-state area at tremendous profit. Fentanyl, right? 10 times more powerful than morphine. 50 times more powerful than heroin. How do I know? I'm weaning off of fentanyl now. That's what I was given as pain relief after that 8-hour operation on October 13th. And it is powerful. So now, he's caught. And he tells the feds, I bought it not for personal use with Bitcoin. I bought it to resell it. Oh, so you're a pusher. And whether you're going to sell it in the streets of Staten Island, or I'm thinking actually outside of Ladder 11 in East Village. He was going to sell in the streets, a pusher man. So what happens? He shows up on Sunday and appears before Brooklyn federal magistrate Judge Stephen Gold with his liar for hire that I think may have been assigned him by the UFA. I'm not totally sure. United Firefighters Association. And then Judge Stephen Gold tells him, hey, Anthony, it's your lucky day because I'm releasing you on a $100,000 bond, which your brother has put up, who I think is a hedge fund monster, and I'm assigning you to a rehab center in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. Now get this line. You may be too affected by the drugs in your system to understand me. You got to stay there. I want to see you clean and sober in a few months. This can be the day that saved your life. If you were a firefighter, you were a brave man. Get this. You are a great man. A great man goes online, buys fentanyl, which kills more now than any other opioid in the streets of America. And he purchases it with Bitcoin to resell it in the streets. And this judge, this magistrate has the chutzpah, the culions, to call him a great man. And so what does Marino do? He leaves the court in the company of his liar for hire, his attorney, and he's got a blanket over his head. And you know what the Gavone did? He walked right into a utility pole. A real Gavone, right? And almost went down for the count. 23 grams of fentanyl and other drugs he was buying from the Red Chinese with Bitcoin. So I would suggest I'm going to volunteer to the UFA, to everybody out there, hey, firefighters, because you're probably protecting this enemy of society and thinking this is a good thing, right? How about if I do a Tony Soprano? Remember what Tony Soprano did with Paulie Walnuts? When all of a sudden Chrissy had that problem with nose candy and they assigned him to a rehab in the Poconos where he was supposed to dry up and they went on a visit to make sure that they put boots to the back of his neck?
We are here to talk about you killing yourself with drugs, not my personality.
That's right.
I'm going to kill myself? The way you... Are you gonna have a heart attack by the time you're 50?
Oh, no. Holy,
sit down.
You're talking to the boss here.
Good, maybe someone will smack some sense into him.
Great, my own mother. Kill you, whore. Oh,
son of a...
Yo, guys, guys, please, come on.
Stop it. Good. He deserved that beatdown. So I'm going to approach this judge, Federal Magistrate Judge Stephen Gold, who tells this pusher guy, this firefighter who's going to sell fentanyl in the streets of our city, who purchased it from the Red Chinese with Bitcoin. I'm going to say, hey, can I visit the rehab center in the Poconos? Can I give him a beatdown, an attitudinal readjustment, which he deserves? Now, you talk about a double standard of justice. This guy's going to walk free because he claims he's addicted. I don't doubt he's addicted. But there are some people who are addicted and they only buy drugs for themselves. Well, they steal for their own to feed their own beast, their own habit. And there are others who decide, no, I'm going to be a menace to society. I'm not only going to continue to be a junkie addicted to fentanyl, but I'm going to bring it in and then I'm going to sell it in the streets and create more junkies. This is a double disgrazia. This is a shanda. I want to hear from the UFA. Are you supporting your brother on this issue? Because if so, oofah to all of you.
Imus in the morning.
So far, so good.
And the drive at 5.
There are so many ways to do it.
On air, online, on the app.
That's unbelievable.
77 WABC.
I want to talk. Pass the joint. I was born a city they call Buffalo. 0 degrees below. It's too damn cold and funky.
Mr. Buffalo himself, no longer on this plane, Rick James, talking about Puff Puff Pass, the joint, and about how he grew up in the streets of Buffalo. Well, he is one of many who can trace their lineage and their success to growing up in Buffalo and Western New York, and specifically Erie County. And a name has emerged out of some who are now wanting to challenge Governor Cuomo in his reelection bid that'll take place this year. His name is Joel Giambra, not a household name downstate here, but definitely up in Erie County, where he served as the county executive for many years. He's an interesting type. He has supported Republicans and Democrats over his career, and he now wants to become the next governor of the state of New York, challenging Andrew Cuomo. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Joel.
Hey, Curtis, how are you?
I'm feeling pretty good today, although the hawk is talking out there. But growing up in Buffalo, this is probably mild weather for you.
You know, it got up to 18 degrees today. We thought about going to the beach.
Right on Lake Erie. But
Yeah.
Want to ask you, you haven't been involved in elective politics in about 10 years. Why all of a sudden have you decided you want to get back into it and become the next governor of the state of New York?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's often asked of me lately, Curtis. And you know, I started out in politics at a very young age. I was elected to the city council in Buffalo at the age of 24. And remember, the year after that is when I asked you to come back to Buffalo to help us with some of the gang problems we were having on the streets of the West Side where I grew up. So I spent, you know, 9 years as a city council member in Buffalo. Then I was elected city comptroller in Buffalo for 9 years, and then I finished my 25 years in elected office as county executive. So my whole life has really been around the issue of, you know, public policy. I enjoy public policy. I enjoy the competition of the politics. And I always felt when I left office in 2007 that I probably had one more race left in me. And I see an opportunity this year to begin to talk about issues that heretofore elected officials on either side of the aisle were reluctant, hesitant, or afraid to speak about. So I saw this as an opportunity to challenge some of the public policies that have been taking place here in New York State for 8 years and begin to raise some different ideas and solutions as to how we can fix some of these systemic problems that we're facing in New York State.
Well, now, it's interesting because you've come up with the idea of supporting the sale of recreational use of marijuana and then actually using the proceeds to fund the MTA, and particularly our dismal subway system here in the five boroughs of the city of New York.
That's something that I'm very, 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 very proud of, being able to put forth a solution that doesn't require, like the mayor of New York City wants, a tax on millionaires. The governor will be shortly proposing this congestion pricing notion, which is literally putting tolls in Manhattan and people from the outer boroughs having to pay for the privilege of driving in the city. And these Democrats are talking about more taxes, Curtis, when we should be talking about reducing taxes, reducing the cost and the size of government. They're talking new taxes. So I believe that, you know, ending this failed public policy of prohibition, which has been going on for over 4 years, it's time for New York State to step up and say we need to take the black market economy and cultivate an entrepreneurial economy. Marijuana and cannabis has become an industry. You and I both know full well from experience the medicinal purposes of medical marijuana. I, as a cancer survivor like you, went through, you know, 14-hour surgery and tremendous pain after that. The inability to eat. So we know firsthand, and science now has proven that marijuana is a very effective for medicinal purposes. And, you know, it's now time to think about the bigger public policy and ending prohibition, to take the money that exists in the underground economy that we're allowing to perpetuate itself and monetize it into a statewide infrastructure program where we can fix our roads and bridges and put people to work in real jobs and not artificial jobs like we've seen the attempt with this administration recently with this whole corporate welfare scenario. Let's create real jobs and let's be real about public policy and end public policy that makes no sense.
Well, no, it's interesting, Joe, when looking at your background, the two high-profile New Yorkers in our political sphere is naturally the president, Donald Trump, who grew up in the Jamaica Estates, very an elite section of Queens, very wealthy section. Andrew Cuomo, the governor, just a few blocks away in Holliswood, very upper middle class. But I'm looking at your background. You grew up in a public housing project in Buffalo, correct?
Yeah, that was something, again, that I would never trade for the world. It was a great experience for me growing up in a housing project where people coexisted who were African-American, Hispanic, Native American. We all had the same thing in common. We were poor, and we learned how to survive in that environment. So it's the stories we have are great, and as a matter of fact, I still live on the west side of Buffalo where I grew up, and I'm actually building houses, Curtis, on lots where people, friends of mine, used to live that were taken down over the years. We're putting new houses on those lots. So it was a great experience for me and something I'll treasure and cherish forever.
Now, question, though, people, when they first hear your name and hear, particularly downstate, that your credibility is based that you were a former Erie County executive as a Republican, but you have also been a Democrat, is they want to know, okay, if you're going to run against Andrew Cuomo, on what line, in what capacity are you going to challenge him to become the next governor?
Well, obviously, I'm very much interested in seeking the Republican nomination. There are some challenges with that because I, of course, am not a traditional Republican. I'm a more of a middle-of-the-road Republican, a big tent philosophy that there's room in the Republican Party tent for all different types of people from different walks of life. And that's the message that I would want to, you know, put forth as a Republican candidate. I also am very much interested in the Reform Party, which you're very familiar with. You know, last night I finished reading the Reform Party platform from cover to cover, and I realized in the first couple of pages that this is pretty much the message that I'm looking to deliver. You know, changing the structure, challenging the system, ending the corruption that takes place. This whole issue with the transit system, Curtis, we saw that, you know, the expose in the New York Times, that there's corruption, there's inefficient bureaucracy, and we have Democratic officials in New York City who are proposing new taxes to put into a system that's structurally unable to fix the problem that they created.
Interesting, Joel Giambro. You are an announced candidate for the governorship to unseat Andrew Cuomo in this general election cycle. You're seeking a line. You've obviously approached me as chairman of the New York State Reform Party and our members to see if we would give you that line. That's a process we'll undergo with you. There's also Kolb, who is the minority leader of the Republicans in the Assembly. He'd like the line, as does Bill Samuels. He's a liberal Democrat, although he hasn't made up his mind yet whether he'll run. It will be some others. But, boy, this whole notion of allowing for recreational sale of marijuana, which is what brand new Governor Murphy in New Jersey wants, but instead to use all the money, the proceeds from the sale of marijuana legally to fund the MTA and the crumbling subway system. Boy, that's got to give everyone out there a little bit pause for thought and say, better to support our subway system through the legal sale of recreational use of marijuana then continue to allow the profits into the black hole of organized crime and specifically street criminals. You'll be hearing more about Joel Giambro, I promise you, here on The Drive Home at 5 and from the New York State Reform Party.
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa.
On the air, on the app. Curtis Sliwa, live.
My boy Curtis Sliwa.
Local.
There's a guy in a red hat.
On it.
Everybody listens to Curtis.
77 WABC.
little special mob talk here as we discuss the geriatric espresso sipping killers of organized crime. And as it relates to the civil rights movement that Martin Luther King Jr. was in the forefront of, and obviously the primary reason that the civil rights legislation was signed by then LBJ. But another backstory that sped up that process was when Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, left New York, went down to join those that were signing up blacks to vote and to break all the poll taxes that had been put up as impediments to them and join James Cheney, a black Mississippian. They had been corralled by the Klan and killed and buried near a water area. And the FBI would like to tell a story that they had recruited Colombo mobster Gregory Scarpa Sr., crazy guy from the Colombo crime family, a guy who had been a valuable FBI snitch. And they sent him to Mississippi to break all the rules, something they couldn't do. Found one of the Klansmen responsible who had a used TV shop, like Crazy Eddie there in Sheepshead Bay years ago. And instead, Gregory Scarpa Sr. said, "Hey, I want to buy a TV. Help me put it in the back of my car." And even though he talked like my cousin Vinny, this Klansman just said, "Yeah, no problem, pal." And as he was putting the used TV in the back of Gregory Scarpa's car, Scarpa hits him in the back of the head, takes him to a shack, then gets a gun, puts it in his mouth, says, "I'm going to blow your effing brains out." And he gives up all the goods and tells the FBI exactly who is responsible. The reason I tell this story is that Edgar Ray Killen, responsible for putting together the Klan plan that killed these three, died in prison on Friday. But I never believed that FBI yarn. I never believed that it was Colombo mobster Gregory Scarpa Sr.